The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Students of the Game. My name is Alex Bauman, and joined by my co-host today, Nathan Glidewell. It was a wild week in college football. We had Georgia on the ropes for the end of the game for Brock Bowers, decided he was going to be the second coming, I don't know what, in the college football game. You had Alabama sneak out of Mississippi State with the win after struggling in the first quarter. And there's a lot more we're going to cover later in the show. But always, we're going to start out with AAA, two stories a day, maybe even a third. So the first one, in a three-team trade, the Milwaukee Bucks have acquired superstar guard Damian Lillard. The Portland Trailblazers have acquired DeAndre Ayton, Jrue Holiday, Toumani Kamara, Milwaukee's 2029 unprotected first-round pick, and an unprotected Milwaukee's first round pick swaps in 2028 and 2030. And the Phoenix Suns have acquired Yusuf Nurkic, Grayson Allen, Nasir Little, and Keon Johnson. And then since that trade, the Trailblazers have flipped Jrue Holiday to the Boston Celtics in exchange for Robert Williams III, Malcolm Brogdon, a 2024 first via the Golden State Warriors, and then Boston's 2029 first round pick. Nathan, it felt like for a while Damian Lillard was going to go to the Miami Heat. It was like a foregone conclusion. And now he's a Milwaukee Buck. Do you like the trade? And what does this mean for the Miami Heat now? Because they didn't make any big moves this offseason.
Well, number one, it caught me off guard because I thought that it was just going to be the Heat taking Damian Lillard. And if it wasn't the Heat, then the Trailblazers wouldn't have traded him. And come around, the trade happens and he's going to Milwaukee. My first thoughts was, is he even going to play for him? Because he made it very clear during this offseason that he only wanted to play for the Miami Heat. Now he's put in this situation. It is a very good situation. You got an MVP alongside you now. So really no excuses not to be able to win a ring. I think I like the trade a lot. For the Bucks, I think Jrue Holiday, even being such a great defender, he lacked a lot of capabilities in the offensive end, and the Milwaukee Bucks already had a hard time stretching the floor with what Giannis has to do in the paint. So adding a guy in Damian Lillard who has unlimited range in that offense, he'll be able to find his own and help stretch the floor and take a lot of the eyes off Giannis, because let's be honest, Giannis gets triple teamed pretty much every play. Through the other teams in the trade, the Suns adding some bench pieces, finally getting rid of DeAndre Ayton. And DeAndre Ayton has not been happy there for a while in Phoenix. Getting a guy in Yusuf Nurkic, who I think adds a lot of value to the team. I don't think he's going to be a great superstar center or anything like that, but he's gonna play his role. He's going to be able to get rebounds, and he's going to bring a lot of energy and tenacity to the team that really needs it. Grayson Allen, good defender, and that he's all right. But I think that was important for the Suns to be able to add some stuff to their bench after they basically spent all their assets on getting every star player in the game of basketball. You look at the Blazers and what they were able to do. Obviously, I think they really eyed around building around Scoot Henderson, the guy they got with the third pick in this NBA offseason. And really being able to flip Jrue Holiday and get a guy in Robert Williams, great defender, adds, I mean, basically almost a replacement for Yusuf Nurkic. I know he's not as big, but I think he's a little bit more athletic and definitely makes up for the loss on the boards there. And honestly, for the Blazers, you got a lot of pieces for Damian Lillard. I wouldn't compare it to like a Paul George Thunder trade. I think that was like probably the biggest trade of all time. But I think what the Blazers were able to do in this scenario, getting the amount of assets they got for a guy in Damian Lillard, they really got all that they could squeeze out of him.
Yeah, I think, like you said, Nathan, the Blazers really maximized Damian Lillard here. I think the Heat were going to offer them something they were interested in because it was going to be centered around a guy in Tyler Hero who plays the guard position. But you look on the Blazers roster, their three best players are the guards, Scoot Henderson, Shaedon Sharpe, and Anfernee Simons. They really don't have a big man. Yusuf Nurkic really didn't play much last season, battled injuries. And when he didn't play, I mean, their backup center was some nobody. I can't even remember his name. I want to say Drew Eubanks, but I believe he was on the Spurs. But it was like some nobody. So them going out and getting DeAndre Ayton, who is going to be their franchise cornerstone at that big man position, but also going out and getting somebody like Robert Williams, he was dealt with injuries of his own, but he's a very good defender in the paint, much more than somebody like DeAndre Ayton, who we saw last season sometimes just half did his job on the defensive end of the court, notably against the Nuggets in that playoff series. But I think Robert Williams is a good pairing alongside DeAndre Ayton, whether that's he comes in and replaces Ayton off the bench or they play next to each other. I like the addition of that. They're reportedly going to move Malcolm Brogdon. And I don't think he's going to play for the Portland Trailblazers just because, like I mentioned, they have the three best players on their team being guards. And I think they're going to maximize or want to get them the most minutes rather than a guy in Malcolm Brogdon, who's more of a veteran. If they don't trade him, I think he's still a great veteran piece to have to kind of mentor these guards, because Brogdon did win a Rookie of the Year back in, I can't remember, I want to say 2016.
It was a while ago.
Yeah. But, I mean, I still think he's a great piece, whether they flip him or not. And then you get all these picks. I know the Milwaukee Bucks picks are probably not going to be high overall picks, and the Warriors probably isn't either, and neither is Boston Celtics. But those are still picks you can use to, let's say you are, for some reason, the Portland Trailblazers are at the 13th pick, and they want to move up to, let's say, the 6th pick. You can use that 13th pick and then the pick you got here to move up to get higher up in that draft pick, the higher draft pick. So I think the Portland Trailblazers did a great job here. The Milwaukee Bucks did a great job here getting Damian Lillard, because like you mentioned, Nathan, Drew Holiday, while he wasn't all-star last year, he's not known to be a shooter. He's a great perimeter defender. That's going to be their big issue now, is they don't have that great perimeter defender. I know Giannis is an defensive player of the year twice, but he's not going to be guarding the ball handler 90% of the time like Drew Holiday was. So they got to go out and get somebody that can do that for the Milwaukee Bucks, because Chris Middleton, he's either injured, or when he plays, he's just an offensive threat. He's not really a 3-and-D type player. So you got to go out and get a 3-and-D type player to replace somebody like Drew Holiday. And then the Phoenix Suns, they get rid of DeAndre Ayton, long time coming. He was not happy there. I think as soon as he was traded, he like unfollowed everybody on the Phoenix Suns. And then he started posting about how happy he was and how free he felt, like he was, like he just got drafted. That was a great addition. That was a great time to get rid of him for the Phoenix Suns, kind of get rid of that locker room cancer. And then bringing a guy like Yusuf Nurkic, like you mentioned earlier, struggled with injuries the past couple of seasons, but when he is healthy, he's a great interior defender. And when you have Bradley Beal, Devin Booker, and Kevin Durant, you're not really looking for a center that's going to go out there and drop 30 points of the game. You're looking for a center that's going to get you 15 to 20 boards, get you 4 blocks a game, just lock down that opposing center like Nikola Jokic. I think that's what Nurkic does. Then you bring in Grayson Allen, who I despise because he played at Duke, but he's a good 3-and-D type player. And then you see Little and Keon Johnson, probably just developmental pieces. They're probably going to stick in the G League for a while. But overall, I think it was a great trade for all the teams involved. They got what they needed, and they're all set up to do what they want to do this upcoming season. Moving on to the next story, spring football leagues, the XFL and the USFL announced they plan to merge and begin playing next year in 2024. Nathan, we spent last year covering the USFL. We didn't really do much with the XFL. I wasn't a huge fan of it, but these leagues are combining. Are you excited for it? And what do you think is going to happen with all these teams? Because each league has 8 teams. I really do not think that this merger can sustain all 16 teams.
Yeah, that was the first idea that came to mind whenever I heard about this news, is a lot of these franchises that are smaller are going to get cut away during this merger. Whenever it takes place, I believe probably the closest we'll see it happen is 2025. I don't believe it's going to happen this upcoming season. A lot to do, a lot of different rule changes. Both leagues had different rule sets of their own, so it's going to be a little complicated trying to figure out what to go with in that scenario. I think implementing a little bit from both leagues, giving the best of both worlds. You talk about what the USFL has done, trying to really modernize the game of football with the drones, with helmet cans, with hot mics on pretty much every player. You have refs with cameras. So, I mean, cameras all over the place. I like that idea. That's one thing the USFL had that I think a lot of people enjoyed. And then the XFL just brings a ton more fans with it. One team I really paid attention to from the XFL was Seattle Battlehawks. AJ McCarron played for them last season. Great team to watch, really offensive, and just their fans were always there. I mean, it was pretty much a packed stadium. So I believe it's a lot more popularity for the XFL that they bring into this merger, and then the minority from the USFL. But you think about what teams might be cut off. I really would hate to see any teams cut off, but you talk about maybe a franchise in the Showboats where they were the Tampa Bay Bandits last season or the year before that, and then they re-ran into the Showboats because there was not enough interest in Tampa Bay. Is there enough interest in Memphis? I think so. It's just going to determine who creates the most viewers, and whoever doesn't is going to get cut from the string.
Yeah, I like the idea because they were kind of competing last season, and not competing is going to be their big thing if they want to, let's say, be like that G League, D League for the NFL, which is kind of what they've been. They've kind of been the experimental league when it comes to these different rules and, like you said, Nathan, the different cameras they're using. So I think this is a great merger. Each side brings something different. You talk about the XFL. They have Dwayne Johnson, the owner there. He has all money, endless money. I know the XFL kind of is losing money every year. They lost money last season, but Dwayne Johnson has notoriety. He's going to bring that there. He's going to be able to continue to pump money into it. So it'll be kind of that face of the new league where the USFL really, I mean, they had Daryl Johnston, but I think The Rock's definitely a bigger face than that for a league. Mm-hmm. And then you talk about the USFL. They're owned by Fox, so they have the TV deal. They did make money last season, so there's that. So I think each one brings something unique to the table, and that's the reason they did end up merging, because I don't think there would have been a possibility for each one to stay competing with each other. There probably would have one would have died off. So I'm excited to see them combine. I'm worried what teams are going to get dropped and cut. I doubt the Stallions do, because it is one back-to-back USFL championships.
There's no way. I will start a riot if that happens.
But if they aren't cut, I just hope they keep the hub cities, or they allow the Birmingham Stallions to have home games in Birmingham. Otherwise, that's the reason we started watching the USFL, is because you could go to the games. And a lot of people in Birmingham love the Stallions, love going to the games, love Skip Holtz, love all the players there. So I just hope they keep either – they do kind of what the XFL did and just have each team have their home stadium, or they do what the USFL did and do hub cities. I don't care either or, just as long as Birmingham has home games in Birmingham. All right, and the last AAA story is the Charlotte Hornets decided to do a jersey patch partnership with YouTuber Mr. Beast and his company Feastables. Nathan, what are your thoughts on the Charlotte Hornets partnering with Mr. Beast to have the Feastables patch on their jerseys this upcoming season?
You're supposed to be a professional brand. You're representing the whole NBA whenever something like this happens. And to be honest, the Charlotte Hornets have been kind of the bozo team of the NBA all offseason. Kai Jones just doing whatever he is doing on social media. He is lost. He is now away from the team. LaMelo Ball getting some of the weirdest tattoos I've ever seen. Do not back him up on that. It seems like the team's all out of sorts, and nothing's happened in the offseason to really improve the chemistry between everyone. I hope I'm wrong in that sense. But then you come out and you're partnering with a influencer. You're partnering with a YouTuber. Guaranteed, Mr. Beast is probably the biggest YouTuber you're ever going to find. He has a lot of money, and that's why he was able to get this deal done. But the fact is, you're representing the whole NBA. And you look at other NBA teams, they're represented by companies. A lot of stuff goes into reputation with that. So let's say Mr. Beast posts something on his YouTube that doesn't represent the Charlotte Hornets in a good way. What does that say about the partnership and how it's going to last? I think that's one reason that all these other teams have not gone with influencers, because there are thousands and thousands of influencers who have the money to be able to get this partnership. But the problem is that all of these teams want to keep their reputation. Obviously, the Charlotte Hornets, it's already so down the dumps that they don't care what happens to it. So that's why they go and partner with Mr. Beast. I really hope it works out for him, but not the move I would have made.
I personally think it was a great move, because it made us talk about it. I mean, can you imagine if they had partnered with, let's say, General Electric? Would we be sitting here talking about the Charlotte Hornets having a partnership with a jersey patch with General Electric? No, we wouldn't even get – we would just like, oh, cool. It would just be something we stroll through. But we're now sitting here talking about the jersey patch partner for the Charlotte Hornets being Mr. Beast. And Mr. Beast is from North Carolina. I can't remember where exactly, but he lives in North Carolina. That's where he's from. So I think it was a great partnership for him. I think it was a great partnership for the Charlotte Hornets because that franchise, like you mentioned, Nathan, has been down in the dumps. But just get Mr. Beast patch. You might get the little kids that watch him every day to go to a Charlotte Hornets game or be a Charlotte Hornets fan. I don't think they probably will be because they'll go, okay, I'm going to go with the Charlotte Hornets for done the past decade.
Nope, we're good.
No, I'm good. I don't want that much pain. But I still think it was a great marketing stunt and great strategy by both sides because Mr. Beast gets PR from it and the Hornets get PR from it. Whether you think it's good or bad, I think it's good for each side. But like you mentioned, Nathan, the downside is what happens if Mr. Beast does something that doesn't line up with the Charlotte Hornets' goals and their standards and everything. I haven't seen Mr. Beast do that. I know there's been rumors of stuff like with his Cloud Kitchens or whatever, his food company not having some issues there, being sued and all that. But Mr. Beast as a whole really doesn't have a lot of bad things said about him, like some other influencers around the world. All I've heard is positive things. And I don't know him personally. That is what I read and what I hear. So I think it was an overall great thing for both sides. All right, moving on to some college football from this past week. Starting with number 12, Alabama versus Mississippi State. Bama ended up winning that game 40-17, making it the 16th straight win for Alabama against Mississippi State. Thank you, Cowbell fans. Starting off Alabama here, Jalen Milroe, once again, I think showed much improvement in this game. 10-12, 164 passing yards, no touchdowns, but he did not turn the ball over at all, whether an interception or fumble, zero turnovers from Milroe. He also had 11 carries for 69 rushing yards and then two rushing touchdowns. One of those being the 53-yard run you've probably seen over and over again on social media. And he was the team's leading rusher. So I think Jalen Milroe, once again, like I mentioned, showed much improvement from the Texas game to now. I think he's probably one of the most improved players in the country. I know his passing doesn't show it as much with the numbers, but he's definitely improved with making decisions. And then you look at the running backs, Jace McClellan, 15 carries, 63 yards and a touchdown. And then Roydell Williams, 10 carries and 44 yards. And you had Justice Haynes come in there in garbage time. And I think he had a pretty good run where he like somersaulted for extra yardage. I hope to see more of Justice Haynes in the future because even though he only got those four carries for 22 yards, he looked pretty good in those, better than Jay Miller's looked all season. So I definitely think he should catapult him in the depth chart the way he's played in garbage time. You know, look at the receivers. No Jermaine Burton this week. He only played a little bit in the first quarter, and then we didn't see him since then. Reports were there was something injury or he wasn't in trouble with Nick Saban, no suspension or anything with the team. They just wanted to hold him out, kind of rest him, and give these younger guys an opportunity after they had taken that big lead against Mississippi State. But the guys that did play, you had Amari Nyeblack at tight end, 3 receptions, 61 yards, and you had Malik Benson behind him with one reception for 27 yards. So I think the receivers played pretty well. Amari Nyeblack really has been that kind of safety blanket for guy Jalen Milroe when he senses pressure or when he gets outside the pocket or he can't get his first read. It's been Amari Nyeblack that's been the go-to guy. I think that connection is going to be something to look forward to, not only the rest of this season, but into next year with these two guys coming back. You look at the defense, continues to be the highlight of this team. You had 4 sacks, 8 tackles for loss, and then 3 interceptions by Chris Braswell, which was for a touchdown. And then you had Caleb Downs and Jahad Campbell get one each for themselves. You didn't have Deontay Lawson, the starting linebacker this week, who's the play caller on defense, kind of the guy that gets everybody set up. But Jahad Campbell took that role here, and I think he played his tail off this entire game. Wherever the ball was, Jahad Campbell was there. He had 14 tackles, half a sack, and then 1 TFL in the interception that I mentioned. I think he played really well in the absence of a guy, Deontay Lawson, who I was really concerned about with him being gone. How are we going to be able to manage that? Because when he left last week, the defense really kind of like discombobulated at the linebacker position. But Jahad Campbell played really well. Nick Saban mentioned getting him experience is going to be the big thing, but he was impressed as well. So good thing for Campbell in the absence of Deontay Lawson. No update if Lawson's going to play this week. But for me, even if Lawson doesn't play, I'm still comfortable with Campbell being that quarterback of the defense. Caleb Downs returned back to former 13 tackles and an interception where the ball was basically just thrown to him. Then you had Trezvan Marshall at linebacker. He had half a sack and then 2 TFLs. He was all over the place on defense for the past couple weeks. I've been kind of worried about Marshall. Thought a guy like Kendrick Blackshear should have been playing over him. But he shut me up this game, played really well against the Mississippi State defensive front or offensive line, sorry, and got in there and got to Will Rogers. Malachi Moore played pretty well, had 2 tackles for loss, and then Dallas Turner had a sack and a tackle for loss. So I think the defense, like I said, has been the highlight of this team, has been the most consistent. And Nick Saban really did get up into him when they started making mistakes. There's some clips on X or Twitter where you can go watch. I mean, Nick Saban really got into Terry and Arnold, man. I mean, he was all up in his grill. I don't know what he did, but it was on the play where Mike Wright got the zone read touchdown, and Nick Saban was not happy with whatever Terry Arnold did. So I was personally excited to see Nick Saban get mad again and get all up into players' faces, because that really shows that the players are comfortable with Nick Saban, and Nick Saban's comfortable with the players. So that once again, a great thing to see. For Mississippi State, I don't know where to go from here. I know Zach Arnett's the first-year head coach. He's a young guy, one of the youngest coaches in college football. But you have Will Rogers, who is one of the most, if not the most, experienced player at the quarterback position in the SEC. And it's like I was watching a freshman. 107 passing yards, one touchdown, and then three interceptions. Outside of the pick six that he threw, I mean, all those passes were horrible. I mean, the one to Jahad Campbell, he threw right to Jahad Campbell. And the one to Caleb Downs, he just kind of like lofted the ball up there, and Caleb Downs just walked into it. I don't know what's going on in Mississippi State. I know this is a new system for Will Rogers, but Will Rogers, like I said, is the most experienced quarterback in the SEC, and he played like a freshman. And then you had their best receiver, Tulu Griffin, that was held at 21 receiving yards. And then the previous week against South Carolina had 256 yards receiving. So that's a big hit for Mississippi State, but that's a good thing for Alabama to be able to hold their star receiver to that much, especially adding into this weekend where you're going to play Texas A&M, who has guys in Evan Stewart and Noah Thomas, who are 6'4", 6'6", 6'5", they're going to be tall receivers. Much different than someone like Tulu Griffin, who's speedy, but, I mean, to be able to hold the leading receiver to only 21 yards is really good. Mississippi State, I don't know if Zach Arnett's the answer. They'll probably give him a couple more years, but I don't see him being the long-term answer head coach. Nathan, what did you see from Alabama this game that gives you hope for next week heading to Texas A&M? And then what do you see from Mississippi State that you were just not happy with?
Yeah, hope is a dangerous thing to have in this day and age in college football, especially if you watch any team, your favorite team, doesn't matter who it is, because having hope just leads you to disappointment 9 times out of 10. I experienced that week 2 after watching this Alabama team play against Texas. Coming out against a Mississippi State team that I really think is underrated. They have a lot of pieces that really can put it together when they can. In this game, they obviously weren't able to. I go back to last week when they played South Carolina, and that's one thing that worried me was just Will Rogers' ability to air the ball out and find guys, and Tulu Griffin, who just were able to make big plays against that South Carolina defense. I know South Carolina's defense doesn't measure quite up to Alabama's defense, but that was one thing that worried me going into this weekend. And when you come out in the game, we had a slow start on the offensive end. We could not put it together. It seems like we made a lot of mistakes. Maybe we were just not able to hear because of the cowbells. But that's one thing you just got to deal with when you go to Mississippi State. But your defense, actually, I'll thank James Burnup, who decided he wanted to land a punt in the 1 yard line and back up Mississippi State's offense. That was beautiful. Dude has been lights out on special teams all year long. He needs more credit. The whole special teams unit needs more credit. I'll give Will Riker his own segment here in a minute. But to start out, the defense found ways to hold Will Rogers and force him into making bad decisions. They were able to make plays, get pressure on him. A lot of it, Kevin Steele called a very aggressive defense again, like he did against Ole Miss. And guess what? It worked. We got to the quarterback. We made Will Rogers make bad plays. We got three turnovers. That is huge in a game. Even one turnover is huge. That is game changing. But three basically seals it for you. Your defense was all over the place. Big credit to Jahad Campbell, what he was able to do in the absence of Deontay Lawson. I thought that was going to be a bigger loss, but Campbell steps in and shows that really, I mean, he can fill the spot as well as Lawson can. Secondary, lights out. I mean, Coley McKintry, you really don't even have to hear about him anymore because they don't even try to test him. They try to test Terry and Arnold every week, but dude has turned into an elite corner. I don't remember the last time Terrion Arnold really just looked absolutely horrible. I mean, you have to go back to last year because he has made so many plays, and I am just so surprised every single week by how much progress he's made. But the defense is elite. You could argue that it's top five in the country. I'd say it's probably easily top five, just the way they're able to constrict opponents. But it all comes down to what Kevin Steele has done and really just simplified the defense during the offseason and created something that's really just go down and find the ball and hit whoever has the ball, get it, whatever you have to do to get a stop. So a lot of credit to the defense. Look at the offense. Tommy Rees has been asked time and time again to figure out something that can complement Jalen Milroe and the type of game that he has. You come out, I know the first few drives, I'm going to go ahead and ignore that because I think it's just a little sloppy. But you come out in the third drive and you see something that I haven't seen in forever is a quarterback draw. And what's beautiful about that, everyone thinks Jalen Milroe on third and 10 or second and 10 is going to throw the ball. But guess what? He drops back for a second and then finds his hole and he takes it to the house. That is a beautiful play call to catch a Mississippi State defense lacking, especially when they just are so used to quarterbacks just driving back to pass. It keeps the defense on their toes. Really did in that scenario. Jalen Milroe was able to make a great play on the ground. Let's be honest, the dude is so fast. He just needs to have more opportunities in the open field like that because he just takes over at that point in time. Look, we only passed the ball 12 times in this game. Jalen Milroe completed 10 of those for 164 yards. I know he didn't have any touchdowns through the air, but every single time the dude was asked to make a throw, he made a pretty good throw and put it in a spot his receiver can get it. And that's all you should really ask of him. Turnovers, that has been the big thing, but none in this game. Really, he's just improved every single week. And that's one thing. I know it's an explosive offense like Bryce Young had, or you go back to Tua or any of that. But Jalen Milroe is such a different quarterback. You can't expect anything like that. And for the simple fact that he didn't turn the ball over, I give Jalen Milroe a lot of props. And a little bit more comfortable going into a weekend versus Texas A&M. Look at the running game. Jace McClellan ran with an attitude the whole game. He found the hole. His offensive line did such a tremendous job. You saw Tyler Pritchett get work at left tackle. Him and Caden Proctor switching in and out. I think the line is kind of a little bit better when Tyler Pritchett is in, just because he can move around a little bit more in pass protect scenarios. But I think both guys do a tremendous job with run blocking. Tyler Booker continues to be such a great guard. There are so many plays. I saw him get a couple of pancakes in this game, but dude needs a lot of credit for what he's been able to do for the entire offensive line. Seth McLaughlin still struggles with snapping the ball. And
get over the play. Go ahead and get over the play.
Yeah, so we'll break this out. I think it was the second drive. It was third down. It was a third and manageable. And Jalen Milroe turned to the sideline, getting the play call in. And Seth McLaughlin, I don't know what in his head cued him to snap the ball, but he just snapped it into the side of Jalen Milroe. Almost a fumble right there, almost a turnover. But luckily, we were able to get back on it. But what it comes down to is Seth McLaughlin just doesn't feel comfortable snapping the football. Whether it be a play like that where there's so much noise, he can't hear what's going on, or a simple play where he just lined up on the football and he's asked to snap the ball. He's dealt with low snaps. He's dealt with high snaps. Don't see really many great snaps. And that's one thing that has to change. I know Jalen Milroe after this game, he said that it's his fault and he needs to take responsibility for it and keep Seth McLaughlin in line. But what it comes down to is Seth McLaughlin needs to be able to make the plays. And if not, he needs to be switched out because we cannot have these moments where Jalen Milroe is having to reach out his feet to catch the football and try to figure something out, because that's just not going to work, especially versus defenses like Texas A&M. So I really hope during this week he has a good week of practice. If not, let's find someone else who can snap the football correctly. the receiving crew, Amari Nyebok has been lights out at the tight end position, really just turned into an all-around receiving threat. The mismatch he had in this game, he really made that apparent, being able to just go up and use his height to catch the ball, getting vertical. Malik Benson found the hole in zone one time for a 26-yard catch. 27-yard catch. But I think the one thing in this offense is we see a lot of the single back. We run a lot of two tight end sets, which allows for guys like C.J. Dupree and Amari Nyebuck to make plays, really good safety valves. You've seen Robbie Oots out there be able to make plays. I know he's not your ideal receiver, but he's been able to make plays. And you really question, can we find more of the playmaking receivers like Jermaine Burton, like Isaiah Bond? And I think there is a point in time where you do need to find them. But when it comes down to is not putting your quarterback in scenarios where he has to force the ball to him. And if your quarterback can find the open guy who is in the middle of the zone, even if it's a 5-yard gain, instead of throwing something deep that might be turned over, I think that's 10 times better. I think that's something that's changed since the beginning of the season, and that continues to develop. I think you got to give Tommy Rees a little bit of credit, and give Tommy Rees credit because he finally ran under center QB sneak. I lost my mind, man. Whenever I saw that happen, I was going up. I was dancing. I was all excited. But anyway, last thing before we move on to another team, Will Reichert, dude's automatic. I have no words. I've never seen a kicker like this in my life. Being an Alabama fan, you know we've dealt with horrible kickers. Andy Papanastas comes to mind instantly. Dude almost sold us a national championship. Adam Griffith, you know what? I don't even want to talk about him because Andy Papanastas is my all-time least favorite kicker that's played for the University of Alabama. But I really think we just need to take a deep breath and think about how great Will Reichert is as a place kicker. Because it's like 25 straight kicks he's made now.
24, 25.
Somewhere around that. That is insane. And that has been like from 50 yards, 40 yards, wherever you need him to kick, he's been able to make it. So this special teams has not been an issue at all, other than Cole McKintry trying to do stupid punt returns.
He does too much.
There was an issue with that. But other than that, I think the team has improved a lot since week two. They continue to improve, and I'm not going to have hope for this weekend because hope always leads to disappointment. Always remember that. But I think that we're going to have an exciting game on our hands come Saturday.
Yeah, you talk about Reichert, Nathan, but don't forget about the backup, Connor Talty. He got in for that kickoff.
I got to give him credit, too.
I mean, that was pretty cool. All right, let's move on to Auburn versus number one Georgia. Georgia ended up winning that game 27-20. It was basically Auburn's game till the second, till late in the third quarter when Brock Bowers started to get going. Looking at Auburn once again, struggled passing the football. Peyton Thorne, 10-19, 82 yards, zero touchdowns and interception. He found success on the ground with 92 rushing yards, most of that being a 61 yard early in the first quarter. He was the team's leading rusher. They bring Robbie Ashford here and there. He was 1-1 for 6 yards, no touchdowns, no interceptions. He had 4 carries for 33 yards and a touchdown on the ground. Then you have Jarquez Hunter, who's basically now the bell cow that Damari Alston is out indefinitely with the injury he suffered last week. Hunter had 19 carries, 59 yards, and a touchdown. Then Batee came in and kind of a receiving duty, 8 carries, 35 yards, and then 3 receptions, 18 yards. They found Rafaldo Fairweather very often, 4 receptions for 44 yards. Outside of that, I mean, you had Kaden Brown, a reception for 14 yards, then Jay Fair, 3 receptions for 12 yards. This offense has been sputtering out of control. Their passing game is not there. And I don't want to blame Peyton Thorne, Robbie Ashford entirely, because there was multiple times this game where Peyton Thorne put the ball in the perfect spot. One time it was to Johnson, Marquez Johnson. Another time I believe it was to Jay Fair. Or no, it was Camden Brown. And he put it in the perfect spot. And the receivers either didn't make the play, or the DB for Georgia, Everett, did a good. He knocked the ball out of Camden Brown's hand. Johnson's hand, sorry. These receivers have to be better catching the ball, especially when Peyton Thorne actually puts the ball in a good place, because that is a very rare occurrence. They got to be able to make plays. The offensive line, I think, did a better job, especially against the Georgia defensive front. They did give up 3 sacks, but that's only 3 sacks. Playing Georgia in the past with Auburn's offensive line, I mean, you would have expected like 10 sacks, how bad Auburn's offensive line was. But I think they did a great job this game for protecting Peyton Thorne, opening up the running holes, learning the lanes for him and the running backs. It just came down to Auburn's passing attack being non-existent. I don't know what to do here. I don't think it would have been fair this game to put in Holden Gariner against Georgia for his first SEC start. Auburn's off this week. Maybe you take this off week and you prepare Holden Gariner for the following week against, I believe, LSU. I still don't think it's a fair thing for him to go against LSU after what they did this past week, even in a loss. I don't know what the answer is for Auburn at quarterback. I guess it's just stick with Peyton Thorne and ride it out to the end of the season. He's the most experienced guy, but it just hasn't worked out. I mean, it's just 2 weeks in a row. He hasn't even hit 100 passing yards, and he has experience. He's a graduate transfer. It's not like he's some freshman, redshirt freshman that came in from Michigan State. He has years of experience as starting quarterback position with really good receivers like Keon Coleman and Jaden Reed. So he's got to be better. But like I mentioned, it's not all on him. The receiver's got to do better catching passes. Look at Auburn's defense. I thought they played really well against Georgia up until that fourth quarter when they decided Brock Bowers was he was just going to be wide open every time. They decided not to defend him as well. They had no sacks. This Auburn defensive line cannot get pressure on the quarterback at all. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's personnel, but they need to figure out something because all season, this Auburn defensive line cannot get to the quarterback. And that's very uncharacteristic of an Auburn defensive line. I mean, you talk about a couple years ago, Derek Hall, Colby Wooden, guys like that. I mean, they'd get to the quarterback. This year, there's just not that above average elite pass rusher that's going to threaten these offensive lines where they're going to have to double team this guy or they're going to have to stunt towards him to prevent him from getting the quarterback. I mean, they're just not that guy. These offensive lines can just get in pass pro easily. That was pretty much their downfall is when they could not get to Carson Beck, it was easy for him to sit back in the pocket and just, you know, throw to Brock Bowers. And that was her downfall. The DBs for Auburn, I think, played very well. They really got into the Georgia receivers. They played really well against Brock Bowers, like I mentioned, up until that late in the third quarter into the fourth. Jalen Simpson got his fourth interception of the year. I believe that leads the country in that matter. They also got a fumble recovery. So they forced two turnovers. I mean, that we talk about a game against Georgia, you need to force turnovers, and they got two of them. But when your offense can't get something, with the quarterback passing, you're not going to win the football game. Larry Nixon, the third, played really well for them. Eight tackles, half a tackle for loss. Eugene Asante continues to be one of the, if not the best linebackers in the SEC. Seven tackles, half a tackle for loss. But for me, the big guy for Auburn this week on the defensive side of the football was Marcus Harris. He was everywhere. Wherever the ball was, Marcus Harris was there. Seven tackles, two TFLs. He had a pass batted down, and then he forced the fumble. He got in there, popped that ball out. I think Marcus Harris is a really good player. He's not some pass rusher, though, so he's not going to be the guy that's going to get to somebody like Carson Beck. So, once again, Auburn has got to find a pass rusher that can get to the quarterback, or they're going to lose the rest of their SEC games. I mean, if you let Will Rogers stand back in the pocket, he's going to dice up your defense. As bad as he played against Alabama, the reason he played so bad is because they got pressure on him. So Auburn has got to find that elite pass rusher, and they got to find some passing offense. That's their two issues right now. You look at Georgia, Carson Beck. I know we had 313 passing yards and a touchdown. He is not the answer at quarterback. I'm sorry, he is not the answer. Y'all will win the national championship if you do, in spite of Carson Beck. He will not be the reason you do. Dejon Edwards, really good. 19 carries, 76 yards, and two touchdowns. Once again, like I've mentioned multiple times already, Brock Bowers was basically the reason they won. Eight receptions, 157 yards, and a touchdown. He only had 9 yards in the first half. So, I mean, Mike Bobo said, you know what? Screw Auburn's defense. We're just going to force the ball to Brock Bowers. And that's basically what Carson Beck did. I mean, there was three or four throws where Carson Beck was just throwing behind Brock Bowers or in places where you would not think a receiver could get the football. And Brock Bowers would just reach behind him, reach over a DB and make a one-handed grab or something. I think if Brock Bowers did not exist on this Georgia roster, Georgia would have lost this game. And if you're a Georgia fan, you cannot debate me on that. Carson Beck would have not done what he did in that second half without Brock Bowers. The defense for Georgia, I think, did a really good job. You had the three sacks, six TFLs, the interception in the game by Malachi Starks. Smell Bundon, 11 tackles, a sack and two TFLs. He was all over the place getting to Peyton Thorne. So I think Georgia, once again, is really good, but their quarterback play is not what it was under Stetson Bennett. And that's saying something because I don't think Stetson Bennett was an amazing quarterback either. Nathan, what did you see from Auburn and then Georgia here?
Yeah, I was just sitting here stewing about this game because Auburn prepared all week for this game. And no doubt, I think they were preparing earlier because they had probably one of the best game plans for a Georgia team I've seen in a while. First half, they played great football. The offense, it wasn't great. But Peyton Thorne, I give credit to a 61-yard run that really got some momentum behind him. Other than that, really, they just relied a lot on guys like Jarquez Hunter to make plays in the red zone and try to find the end zone, which in scenarios like that against a Georgia defense, that is pretty good. You're not going to have a lot of success, but they were still able to do it a few times. They brought Robert Ashford in to see what he could do in the red zone. He was able to get a touchdown on the ground, so that was good for him. But what it comes down to is when Auburn takes the field on offense, you know what their limitations are. You know they can run the ball. You know they have receivers who can make plays. But the whole problem is they don't have a quarterback that can throw the ball to the playmaking receivers. And when you have an offense that can't pass the ball well, you're going to have a one-dimensional offense that can only run. And that makes the defense's job 10 times easier. That allows Georgia to sack the box against you. That allows Georgia to make you throw the ball and really make you make mistakes. And Peyton Thorne, he only had one interception. And I get it was on the final drive of the game. Other than that, I think he played pretty mistake-free football. But it was also to a point where it was way too conservative. You're not going to beat Georgia by just hitting the check down every single time. You're going to have to try to force some throws in there sometimes or try to get out of the pocket and make something happen, which I think he was looking to do sometimes. But it's a confidence thing at this point because not a lot of Auburn fans have confidence in their quarterback system. And honestly, rightly so, because Peyton Thorne cannot pass the ball. He cannot do it. But it's not like Robbie Ashford can come in and pass the ball either. Dude is way more inaccurate than Peyton Thorne is, and Holden Garner is just nowhere close to being ready. So, Auburn, I don't know what your answer is at quarterback. I think you're just going to have to stick with Peyton Thorne. He gives you the best chance to win, but you're going to have to change up your play calling on the offensive end to get you in situations to win games, because this is a very winnable game. I look at Auburn's defense. See, they really got after it in the first half. Getting Carson Beck to turn the ball over, I think that was huge. They were able to get stops, get off the field when they needed to. It was, what, a 20-20 score at half or 10-10, something like that. It was a tie in half. And really, you can't ask much more of the defense than that, especially with how many playmakers Georgia has on the offensive side of the ball. But when you come out in the second half and it's like you completely forget or blank on your game plan entirely and you just leave Brock Bowers open or just let him do whatever he wants your defense, that's not the recipe for winning. You played – I just don't get how you can go from the first half only allowing 9 yards to Brock Bowers to then proceeding to give up 150. It's crazy. Brock Bowers was easily the difference in this game. And Georgia, they're not an elite team. They're really not. They have holes on the defense. I really don't think their defensive front is as good as it was a year or two prior. Their DBs, they're decent, but they're still kind of young and still kind of filling into the position. You look at the offense, I don't think the offensive line is near as good. I still think they're pretty good, but I don't think they're near as good. I think they're vulnerable, especially at the tackle positions. The running back room for Georgia is still pretty good. But when you look at their quarterback, Carson Beck he just does not look comfortable in whatever he does. And that really goes back to previous weeks. You talked about the UAB league. He looked just out of sorts, especially in the first half in that game. He got back to South Carolina first half. Really the second half too, he just did not look good at all. The difference was that he had a running game to back him up. A guy named Brock Bowers, which dude is probably second best player in college football, best non-quarterback, because Caleb Williams is just on another level. He's basically an NFL player at this point. But Georgia, they don't play a hard schedule. And I think you argue that this is the hardest game that they're going to play all season, or during the regular season anyway. And really, Auburn had a shot to win this. And for them to come out this close at home, this short, and to know that they were right there to upsetting the number one team in the country, it hurts some fans, but you got to hold your head high, because for your coaching staff, for your players and personnel to put the team in a situation like this, to even come close to winning a game like this, it's much improvement for the Texas A&M week from weeks prior. And Auburn's moving in the right direction. It's just not going to be an instant change. So you just got to be patient with what goes on there.
Patience is the key word, especially with new coaches and all that. Got to be patient. Talk about patience. I got to have patience with UAB because they go ahead and lose to Tulane 35-23. Had a chance, but they just choked it away. They are now 1-4 and 0-1 in the American Athletic Conference. Rough season for Trent Dilfer in his first year, but it's his first year. I got to be patient with it. I think he's a great coach. It's just gotta take a minute, especially when you're in a new conference with a new head coach. And then you had Jacksonville State pick up a win against Sam Houston, 35-28. Jacksonville State was down 21-7 at halftime, but stormed back and got the win there. They are now 4-1 and 2-0 in Conference USA. And, I mean, Jacksonville State's doing pretty good in their first year in college football, up in this level of it, at least. All right, then basically the big game this week, you had number 20, Ole Miss, take on number 13, LSU. Ole Miss ended up upsetting LSU 55-49 in a game where defense just was optional, I guess, because there was none played by either side. I don't know what Matt House and Pete Golding were doing, but apparently it was just coloring in a coloring book all day, because they just gave up yard after yard after yard. Look at Ole Miss, Jackson Dart, 389 passing yards, 4 touchdowns, no interceptions, and then 50 rushing yards and a touchdown on the ground as well. Quinshon Judkins really found his footing, kind of returned to last year's form. 177 rushing yards and a touchdown. Then he had a receiving touchdown of his own. But also the use of Ulysses Bentley, the fourth. The past couple of weeks, Lane Kiffin was trying to implement him more and more in the offense. And this week, once again, he did a great job of doing that. He had 90 rushing yards of his own and then a touchdown on the ground. You had Trey Harris, after last week, kind of dealing with an injury against Alabama, comes in, 153 yards receiving and then a touchdown. And you had Jordan Watkins and Dayton Wade have touchdowns of their own. The offense as a whole, 706 total yards and 307 rushing yards. I mean, that is absurd in the SEC. I mean, you're talking about SEC, defense is where you want to go, where you want to watch by the SEC. That's where you go to watch defense. I mean, but this game, I don't know what was going on. And you look at LSU, Jaden Daniels, very good performance, 414 passing yards, 4 touchdowns, no interceptions. Then he had 99 rushing yards and a touchdown on the ground. Also had a fumble lost. He got popped two different times. I mean, he got laid out. He's got to learn to slide or something or get out of bounds, because he's going to get a concussion if he does not learn to get down. I mean, he got leveled twice, and I was surprised they didn't pull him out of the game for a concussion, because he got hit pretty hard. Running back Logan Diggs, 101 rushing yards on the ground, 2 touchdowns, and then the 2 sub receivers at LSU, which they always seem to have. Brian Thomas Jr., 8 receptions, 124 yards, 3 touchdowns. And Malik Nabers, 102 yards of his own. And LSU defense, 0 sacks, 6 TFLs. Looking at LSU's defense, there is no reason why they should have 0 sacks in a game. You have Harold Perkins, Makai Wingo, guys like that, and you cannot get to the quarterback, cannot get a sack. Especially after last week's performance against Alabama, like Ole Miss had. I mean, I don't know what Matt House is doing. You look at the past 2 games for LSU's defense. 86 points allowed, 1,132 yards allowed, 17-29 on third downs, and then a 300-plus rushing and passing yard game. I mean, should Matt House have a job after this week, Nathan?
You know, it's too soon to pull the plug on a coach like this. I think you really look to the inexperience of the defense. It was kind of just meshed together during the offseason. I think they brought in like 22 defensive transfers. So expecting a group of guys like that to just mesh together and play instantly better is kind of bad. And really, Brian Kelly talked about it this offseason, and that was like the biggest worry for him. And it's just, you know, nightmares become a reality because LSU cannot stop a feather falling from the sky. I really don't understand well what's going on there. I look back to the game Ole Miss had against Alabama and how Alabama's defense got after Jackson Dart, and I really think that was the key factor, because you look in this game, they weren't able to get any pressure on Jackson Dart whatsoever. Jackson Dart was just able to stay in the pocket and keep his eyes downfield, and when he was forced out of the pocket, he was just able to slide a little bit to the right and find whatever receiver wide open. The secondary for LSU is just awful. Couldn't cover anything. It is unbelievable. I think about watching the game, and for LSU to have this elite of an offense, for them to have a Heisman candidate at quarterback, and then you turn around and you look at their defense and you're like, well, what is this? Because this is not an LSU team I recognize. LSU has always had at least some sort of identity on defense. They have none. And I'm not letting LSU off the hook here either, because Ole Miss's defense is awful as well. Pete Golding there, I am so glad he's gone from Alabama, because he is doing the exact same thing to Ole Miss. And it just so happens that Ole Miss's offense and Lane Kiffin just understand the game a little bit better than Pete Golding was trying to sell. Because let's be honest, Pete Golding was selling this game hard. He was riding on LSU winning this game. I don't know how much money he bet on it, but Lord, he was trying hard. Ole Miss on the offensive end, Quinn Judkins equation, he's something else. I go back to last season, how explosive he was. I know he hasn't been super explosive to start the season, but he just picks it up in this game. 33 carries, 177 yards on the ground, and a touchdown, as well as a reception for 4 yards and touchdown through the air. I mean, that is just something special. And you talk about USC's Bailey the fourth. He came in and really just reprieved Quinshon Judkins of all the running he had to do, and bro was just a wrecking ball of his own. 9 carries, 90 yards, and a touchdown on the ground. Both those guys, I'm not going to say they're one of the best running back duos in the country, but they're definitely up there. They're just so explosive. You look at the wide receiver core for Ole Miss. They weren't able to do anything last week versus Alabama. They got no separation. And they come out in this game, and they're just running free. And they're wide open half the time. So you got to give credit to Lane Kiffin and the play calling that Ole Miss had in this game. Just a different level. LSU, your chances of making the college football playoff are over.
Done.
They're done. They are out the window. I don't know how many more games you're going to win. They honestly should have lost versus Arkansas at home, and they really got bailed out by their offense. Can't happen this week. How many more weeks is LSU's defense just going to go out in the field and start picking daisies? Are they going to get off the bus next week? Did they sleep in the hotel room? Did they even make the flight to an away game? I don't know. But LSU's defense is horrible. Probably the worst in the SEC, and Ole Miss is right there with them. And awful. Absolutely awful.
Oh, Lord. If you're an Ole Miss fan, though, you're a huge A&M fan this weekend. You want A&M to beat Alabama, and then you can beat up on A&M. So as you're an Ole Miss fan, you're a big A&M fan. LSU, I don't know what you're a fan of. Maybe trying to win football games and play defense when you do so.
Bourbon.
whatever. I mean, this was a great offensive game. Like I mentioned, terrible defensive game on both sides. Upsets this week, you had number 19, Oregon State. Beat number 10, Utah, 21-7. Utah's quarterbacks, no Cam Rising once again. So you had Bryson Barnes and Nate Johnson kind of play, both play. The quarterbacks went 13-31, 141 yards, a touchdown and an interception. And then the team rushing yards had 57 yards on the ground on 32 carries. So basically the whole offense is ineffective, as you can tell by the 7 points they scored. Then you have Oregon State quarterback DJ Uiagalelei, 14-25, 204 yards, a touchdown and an interception. And then he had 6 carries for 18 yards on the ground. So DJ is really sticking it to Dabo right now, because Oregon State looks 10 times better than someone like Clemson, because they're actually in the top 25. Another upset is you had Kentucky beat number 22 Florida, 33-14. Ray Davis absolutely ran all over Florida, 26 carries, 280 yards, 3 touchdowns, then had a receiving touchdown of his own. Devin Leary really didn't have to do much. He only had 69 passing yards and a touchdown. And Florida, on the other hand, was held to 69 rushing yards on 29 carries. when a couple weeks ago when we were covering Florida, when they beat Tennessee, they ran all over Tennessee. So I think Kentucky had a great game plan for that. Really forced Gray Mertz to beat them, and he couldn't. And Ray Davis had the game of his life.
Some people say he's still running right now.
Florida's still chasing him. Austin Armstrong still trying to figure out how to stop him. Another upset. Bowling Green beats Georgia Tech 38-27. Thank you, Haynes King and Georgia Tech, for losing to Bowling Green. Oh. And then the most surprising upset of the week outside of that one, Baylor beats UCF 36-35 after coming back from 35-7 with 28 points down in the third quarter, which to win the largest comeback in Baylor history, and UFC allowed the largest comeback in their history. Just a note here, UFC quarterback John Rhys Plumlee was out for the game, and UCF did have a chance at the end there. There was some play on I saw on social media where the quarterback ran like he was playing Madden with Michael Vick, just ran like a complete circle and found the guy for the first down, but it wasn't enough. And funny enough, the Hornets commentator Eric Collins was commentating that, so you know, that made it like 1,000 times better. But unfortunately, UCF lets Baylor get their first Power 5 win of the season. Some other storylines here. Number 3, Texas, pulls away from number 24, Kansas, in the second half to win 40-14. Kansas quarterback Jalen Daniels did not play this game, and the backup, Jason Bean, looked inept at quarterback. I don't know what he was seeing. Maybe some ghost out there. You look at Texas running back Jonathan Brooks, 21 carries, 218 yards, and 2 touchdowns. He's been really great in the replacement of Bijan Robinson. Not the same player, but has done a great job in replacement there. Kansas loses. I was kind of expecting them to win this game, but when Jalen Daniels doesn't play, I mean, I was expecting them to lose it at that point. Hopefully, Kansas can win out and get to the Big 12 championship like I expect, because I think if Jalen Daniels does play, they have a fighting chance against Texas, because up until a little late into the third quarter, they had Texas on the ropes. Next is number 7, Washington, barely escapes Arizona, 31-24. Michael Penix Jr. Passes for 336 yards, but failed to find the end zone for the first time this season. The running backs did help him out, though, with 4 combined touchdowns. I do think this probably takes a hit to Michael Penix Jr.'s Heisman campaign, because then talk about this game. Number 8, USC, staves off a late comeback by Colorado to win 48-41. And the quarterback, Caleb Williams, 403 passing yards,
he's Heisman.
6 touchdowns. And one interception. And then Shedeur Sanders played pretty good compared to last week. 371 passing yards, 4 touchdowns, and then 50 rushing yards and a rushing touchdown of his own. But then you had the freshman wide receiver for Colorado who got a chance to play, Amarion Miller. He had 196 receiving yards and then a touchdown. So they got him going. They also played 5-star corner Cormani McClain. He got some reps, but it just wasn't enough for Colorado to upset somebody like USC and Caleb Williams. Audric Estime for Notre Dame scored the go-ahead 30-yard rushing touchdown to help number 11 Notre Dame beat number 17 Duke 21-14 on College Game Day. Duke quarterback Riley Leonard fumbled on the final drive to end the game. Leonard was injured on the play and left on crutches. Head coach Mike Elko for Duke did not offer details or an update on the injury after the game, and there's still an update as we record this video, so I'm not sure what that means. It did not look great. I doubt Leonard probably plays the next couple of weeks, might be out for the season. But for Duke, that's a huge loss if he is, because he's basically been their entire offense, especially this game he was. Number 21, Tennessee gets their revenge for last year's game with a 41-20 win over South Carolina, because last year South Carolina basically ended Tennessee's hopes of getting to the college football playoff after the Spencer Rattler legacy game he had. So Tennessee gets their revenge on South Carolina. Despite losing starting quarterback Connor Wegman for the season, Texas A&M and backup quarterback Max Johnson beat Arkansas 34-22. Johnson, 17-28, 210 yards, 2 touchdowns, had an interception, but also had 57 rushing yards. And then Arkansas quarterback KJ Jefferson, pretty underwhelming in my opinion, 9-17, 132 yards, 1 touchdown, 1 interception, and then he had 18 carries for negative 3 yards. Worth noting here, A&M's defense, once again, I believe this was the same exact numbers they had last week against Auburn, 7 sacks and 15 TFLs. And then linebacker Adrian Cooper, I mean, dude might be in contention for the SEC Player of the Year the way he's been playing. 6 tackles, 4 solo, 2 sacks, and 3 TFLs. If you look at the overall A&M game here, I mean, is Sam Pittman's time up? It's kind of like a Mel Tucker situation outside of Sam Pittman. Mel Tucker, I mean, doing whatever he did with allegations he's got against him. But Sam Pittman had that one good year, Arkansas, with foaming at the mouth and signed him to an extension. They paid him more. And since that year, not very good. KJ Jefferson, for as long as he's been in the SEC, like Will Rogers, I mean, he got out of play by a backup. Well, is Sam Pittman's time up? And what's wrong with KJ Jefferson?
Like, it's not something wrong with KJ Jefferson. And I don't think the answer is to fire Sam Pittman, because I do believe Sam Pittman has the resources to be a great coach. And I honestly think that he does a lot more with a lot less. But you look at the situation that Arkansas is in as a team right now, their offensive line is like Swiss cheese. It has holes all in it. And that's where you need to start. You need to find pieces to plug in that can help protect KJ Jefferson a lot more in the pocket, because he's had no time in the pocket. Other than the LSU game, he's been scrambling for his life and had to make improvised throws on the run, or whether that be running for the first down or whatever he tries to do out in the open field. But asking so much of KJ Jefferson to be that playmaker in the offensive end, that is not fair to him. And honestly, that's not fair to your offense as a whole, because your receivers do not get time to actually make plays when they're open. Look, it's not an easy fit for Arkansas. I really think the window for fixing it was probably after week one, and probably before that in the offseason. But we're here now. You already are pretty much, I'd say, eliminated from winning the SEC West. You're lost to LSU, not Seattle, and then you go and lose to Texas A&M. I don't see them really making a run like that anymore. And then not this next weekend, but the week after, you had to go to Alabama. Forget it. You're not going to be able to even come close to scoring 20 points in this defense. There's a lot of bad things going on in Arkansas right now. And it's really just sad, because they have talent and they should be doing a lot more. And it's not just Sam Pittman's fault. There's a lot of people to blame for it, and it's just not something that's going to be fixed during the season.
And the last thing before we end today, Maryland improves to 5-0 with Ohio State up next behind Tulia Tagovailoa's 352 passing yards and 5 touchdowns. I am hoping and praying, and I really do predict here that Maryland does beat Ohio State next week. I really do. I really think they do.
Alex. It's not going to happen. I've wanted it to happen every single year, and they've gotten close several years, and then they just give it away at the last second. I love Tulia. Wish he would have stayed at Alabama and developed, but for him to be doing what he's been doing at Maryland is just insane. That Maryland team, great offense, defense, lacking. And that's the difference, so... We'll see what happens going forward. I don't predict the upset, but Maryland does look pretty good. They're 5-0 to start off, and that's more than you can ask.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening and watching, Students of the Game.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.